Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the implications of moral distress and clinical decision-making in the time of COVID-19? And first, the global COVID-19 pandemic has provided new openings to link global health with climate action. This will influence the upcoming meetings on global climate change called COP26. Contributing host Doug Becker explores with Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California.
On December 12, 2015, the nations of the world agreed to the Paris Climate Accord. These are intended to slow the rate of climate change. Since this historic date, the U.S. announced its intention to withdraw, and the pandemic has had a profound impact on the agreement. On today's show, we discuss both the effects of the American withdrawal and the effects of the pandemic on future agreements on the Paris Climate Accords. My guest is Shannon Gibson. She is Associate Professor of Political Science, International Relations, and Environmental Studies at the University of Southern California. She is the author of the upcoming book, Politics of the Global Environment, that's due in spring of 2021. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. First, can we start with a discussion of what the Paris Climate Accords are and what they're intended to try to address in the way they approach that?
Sure. So the Paris Climate Accords are basically the second major international treaty that we have to deal with climate change at this point. Preceding the Paris Climate Accords, we had the Kyoto Protocol, which originated in the 1990s. Only ran for a very short time period, had about a five-year commitment time period with very mixed record. It only applied to developed countries in terms of which countries were required to reduce their emissions. Developing countries got a little bit of sort of a time lag in terms of when they were supposed to join on board. And so what we see is that among those developed countries, some countries met their targets, some did not. But at the end of the day, global emissions continued to rise. So in terms of the end goal of the treaty, it was not successful. So recognizing that, countries early on in the sort of early 2000s realized that we needed a successor treaty when the Kyoto Protocol expired in 2012. And so as part of that, they began negotiating a successor treaty, which was supposed to have arrived in 2009 in Copenhagen. That is the first time I went to the climate talks. And famously, those talks fell apart, quite tragically, and played out for the media. And so that's how we ended up with the Paris agreements, is that a new timeline was set, or a new deadline was set for 2015. So at that time in 2015, it's been noted as a very historic agreement because we did get international consensus. This treaty does apply to developed and developing countries, with the main goal of reducing what we call historical temperatures to 2 degrees Celsius, or keeping them at that level with an ambition of a 1.5 degree target. And so coming up here with COP26 is going to be the first time for us to sort of verify what did countries commit to and have they met their targets that they established for themselves.
What exactly is a COP meeting?
So COP stands for the Conference of Parties. And so COP26 means that this is, sadly, the 26th year we have been negotiating on climate change. And with not too much to show for it in terms of reducing global emissions. And so what the COP means is basically it's the meeting of all the parties to the Convention on Climate Change, which is sort of the umbrella negotiating entity that the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Agreement fall under.
So in essence, the COP meetings are the countries that have agreed to the legal instrument, agreed to deal with climate change, getting together to try to strengthen the agreements, monitor compliance with the agreement, possibly suggest future agreements. Is that fair to say?
Yes, exactly. And so, for example, being a member of the COP, it's very inclusive. For example, the Holy See is a signatory and an observer member for that. And the United States, even if we leave the Paris Agreement, we will still be part of the COP because we are still a signatory of the Framework Convention on Climate Change.
Right. And that dates back to 1992 and the Rio Conference.
That's correct.
With that, okay. So how often do these COP meetings meet?
So they're annual. When you look at all the different environmental regimes, we're one of the few. So for example, when it comes to endangered species, they meet every 3 years. Biodiversity is every two. Climate change is annual. And they usually always happen in November and December of each year, except for this year, where obviously our time schedule has changed as a result of the coronavirus outbreak.
So there's two major developments I wanted to talk about. But since you mentioned the coronavirus outbreak, and of course it's on all of our minds at this point, you being shut in as a result of this, what have been some of the effects on climate negotiations that this global pandemic, you know, have had?
Well, I think from my perspective, just to provide a little background, when I attend the climate negotiations, I attend as an observer with an environmental NGO, a non-governmental organization. So I kind of come at it from a different perspective, more so the civil society perspective than, say, serving on a state delegation. And I can say for civil society, this has presented a number of changes. For decades now, NGOs, civil society groups, and developing countries have been trying to make this point or this connection between human health and climate change and have not done so very successfully. Instead, the arguments that tend to make more sense or to gain more traction have to do with the economics of climate change, maybe the winners or losers of climate change. But the health rhetoric really just has not gained traction. That's changing right now. There is a big focus on air pollution, particulate matter pollution, and how that has direct correlations with COVID-19 mortality. We're also seeing, again, parallels with regards to climate change and the coronavirus and what a lot of the civil society groups are saying, that these are both basically symptoms of the same broken system, right? That these are a result of broken political and economic systems. So I think what's interesting is that in the framing of this is that we're getting more emphasis on these human health aspects, but also this joining of these two issues, which maybe gives a little bit more emphasis or urgency to dealing with climate change, because like global public health and infectious diseases, it's something that we continually put off and think it's never going to happen. And COVID-19 shows us it's going to happen.
You're seeing this linkage. The linkage largely coming from civil society groups, are we also seeing state actors starting to draw this linkage a little bit more closely?
Oh, yes, especially in terms of when you think about vulnerabilities. The Global South has been particularly vocal about this. And they've been doing this, and they've been trying to make this point for a while. If you look back at, for example, outbreaks relating to malaria, West Nile, other what we call sort of zoonotic or vector-borne diseases like those coming from mosquitoes, there's always been this strong argument that ecological changes in patterns, whether it be droughts, floods, an ENSO cycle, something like that, those have direct correlations with the transmission of vector-borne diseases like dengue, leishmaniasis, et cetera. So they've been trying to make that point for so long, but for some reason, developed countries, perhaps because the developed countries don't experience those tropical type diseases as much, have not given it much credence. But I think now that rhetoric is so much stronger when we see an outbreak or a pandemic that is truly global in nature. And there are some ties here with this likely being a zoonotic disease, and something that has emerged as a result of interference with ecological or ecosystems.
Are there specific leaders in making these sorts of connections? Are there certain states that have been particularly vocal about this, or certain non-governmental organizations that have been particularly vocal?
It hasn't been so much states that I've noticed yet, just because it seems as though all the states are solely focused on the coronavirus. So they're sort of pushing off their negotiations. But civil society, I mean, when you look at the entire spectrum of the environmental movement, from the large transnational NGOs like Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, 350.org, Conservation International, to the more radical groups like Extinction Rebellion, the Sunrise Movement, they're the ones that are really pushing this rhetoric. And my experience in negotiations is that oftentimes it's this sort of pattern that we call diagonalism, where civil society and developing countries will eventually sync up in their framing and their rhetoric. Sometimes developing countries lead, sometimes civil society does. But I would not be surprised in COP26 to see a very strong alliance among civil society, and particularly G77 or developing countries, being really vocal about this in these upcoming negotiations.
Interesting. When is COP26 and where is it scheduled?
So it was originally supposed to be in November of this year, and now they have delayed it to an undetermined date, likely in mid-2021. It was supposed to have been held in Glasgow, Scotland, hosted by the United Kingdom. However, we don't know the date. We also don't know the format. Is it going to be held as a physical negotiation, or is it going to be a virtual negotiation? One challenge with the physical aspect logistically is that both the conference center in Glasgow and its backup location in London have become field hospitals. So there's a big concern about, is there even going to be the infrastructure available? Will they have time to get those facilities, if they're free and clear, to even get them ready? And then that brings up the idea of a virtual negotiation, which has both pros and cons associated with that format.
I want to get into the pros and cons in a moment, but I find the fact that Glasgow and the UK would be the host fascinating, because my understanding is the UK has actually become a bit more vocal about climate change, in part as an island nation. I know there's a coalition of island nations that have been particularly vocal about the need for action. Is it fair to say that the UK is joining that coalition, or is that a bit of an overstatement with respect to the UK's commitment to climate action?
The UK is a hard one to peg down right now, to be honest, because on the one hand, when they were a part of the EU, they were a leader in terms of taking on climate in terms of what we call burden sharing. So when the EU signed on to the Kyoto Protocol and then later the Paris Agreement, they did it as a regional bloc. And then within that regional bloc, they split up the mitigation targets based on the capability of each country and the historical responsibility in terms of who contributed the most to climate change. And so the UK typically took one of the largest reduction targets. Now with Brexit, that all has to be renegotiated. What's interesting is that Boris Johnson has kind of indicated dual positions. On the one hand, he's a friend of President Trump, it seems, in some cases, and does like to foster this idea of free trade and opening up economies and things that sometimes work against lowering one's emissions, but also still wants to be a leader in some of these normative issues like climate change outside of the EU. So there's been a little bit of mixed messaging in terms of what we can expect from them at the negotiations.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the future of the Paris Climate Accords after the U.S. withdrawal and the global pandemic with Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. So, Professor Gibson, on the next question, you had mentioned there's pros and cons to the idea of a virtual meeting. I mean, I can think of one obvious pro, which is no air travel, and so therefore not contributing. But tell me a bit more about what these pros and cons are.
And that's one thing. It is one of sort of the great hypocrisies of these mega conferences, is that scholars, activists, delegates travel hundreds, thousands of miles yearly in order to engage in mitigation talks. So there is that one thing, is that this will obviously, if it were online, it would lower the carbon footprint of having these major events. On the pro side, additionally, some have said that this could be sort of like the great equalizer. Typically in the United Nations, we kind of hear this ideal of it being one state, one vote, all countries have the same footing, which is different than, say, organizations like the World Bank or the IMF, where countries get votes based on, you know, how much money they contribute to the fund. But in reality, at these negotiations, power does matter. I can tell you, when I attended the first talks that I went to in Copenhagen, I was shocked to see the first day when the U.S. delegation walked in with 300 members. And then small developing countries come in with 8 people, 12 people. The Maldives has, you know, a group of 20, right? So these power politics still play out. And so one argument is that if this is online, then you don't have countries being restricted by necessarily finances, economics, capacity, expertise, things like that. On the flip side of that, though, there are others that are concerned that if it goes online, it creates a potential for less transparency, that more deals will be worked out in. Normally it happens in the halls and the bars around the climate talks. Now the concerns is that there will be sort of like sidebar Zoom rooms, right? That that there will be more closed door talks, that there will be exclusion of stakeholders like civil society, indigenous peoples organizations, groups of that nature. And then finally, we have to take into account the digital divide, right? So even though theoretically as many people as possible could attend per group or per state, we do have issues with hardware, software, Wi-Fi capacity, and what will be the challenges if people simply aren't able to connect? How do they work around that?
And I can tell you that what you just described about the size of delegations, tied to that might be the level of expertise of each person who's there, or even just a physical show, is something that's fairly common in kind of all UN meetings, which we, you know, that's not unique to environmental negotiations. It's kind of a feature of negotiations throughout the UN system.
Exactly.
So now the US announced its intention to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accords. I always find it interesting that the accords themselves had built in but that withdrawal cannot take place until, was it November 4th, 2020, or the day after the election? Mm-hmm. And I always like to remind people, my students, that that was negotiated before we had any idea who the candidates were going to be, including the current president, who actually had not even declared his candidacy by that point. But with that in mind, the U.S. cannot withdraw after the election. So I guess two questions. First, what are the effects of the announcement of the withdrawal? And then second, I'll let you know what the question is going to be, which is, how important is this election specifically to this COP meeting, considering that no matter how the election turns out, the current president is going to be president the day after the election. But the first question about the effects of the U.S. announcement of the withdrawal on this meeting itself.
Yeah, so the timing of the meeting with our U.S. political system created sort of a weird conundrum and almost like a lame duck position for the United States in the talks if they were to have been in November. And so you mentioned before that we have that this was written into the treaty. And so basically what's written into the treaty is similar to when people file for divorce, they have a cooling off period, right? So you file for divorce, you have to wait a couple months before it becomes official. That's what they do with withdrawals in climate or in UN treaties in a lot of cases, that you notify the UN through a communique, and then you have a 1 year limit or 1 year waiting period until it becomes official. And so for us, based on when we signed the treaty, when we notified the UN, that day happens to be the day after our next presidential election. So had the talks been in November, basically the US would have been removed from the Paris Accords no matter what. Regardless of who wins the presidential election, mm-hmm. We will be removed from the Paris Agreement. So what that meant was that if it were to happen in November, we would not be a part of the Paris Agreement and you would have a Trump delegation going to the climate talks. My experience at COP23 in Bonn, which was the first Trump delegation to attend the climate talks, is that looks a little bit like sending lower level delegates, not sort of the heavy hitters within your EPA or other agencies, and hosting side events that tout clean coal and fracking. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's what we would have seen. Now with it being moved to mid-2021, it's a game changer. Because if we get a Democratic president that is inaugurated early next year, on the day of their inauguration by executive order, we can rejoin the Paris Agreement because of the nature and the structure of the treaty, it doesn't require Senate approval. So we could rejoin. And then in mid 2021, if we have a climate friendly, administration, we could reenter the treaty with full force and start putting pressure on other countries to pick up their slack as well.
So the fact that the COP meeting was pushed beyond, first of all, how much does that raise this issue potentially in the American election? And, you know, how important is climate change going to be in the American election? And how important is the election to the success of the COP agreement? You know, or to the top meetings to come to an agreement?
I think in a non-coronavirus world, it would have. I think we see that coronavirus is like the political vacuum of all time, right? It's the right, one right. thing that every, but we did see this prior to the outbreak. When you looked at the Democratic debates during the primaries, climate change, I mean, it wasn't mentioned as much as I would think that it should be, but it was mentioned way more than it ever has been before. Right. And so especially with this new momentum or that what was the momentum behind the Green New Deal, I think it has been raised in the consciousness of the two-party system in the United States. The other thing I'll say, though, is that globally, even with the U.S. withdrawing, Paris didn't burn down. Right. The treaty still continued. Countries did not leave. China stayed in. India stayed in. The EU stayed in. So I think that, you know, I fear that climate change won't be on the presidential debate topics as much as it should be because of coronavirus. But once we get to COP26, I think the world will be happy to welcome the U.S. back. But if we're not back, they're going to keep negotiating and implementing without us.
Now, one of the key elements of the Paris Accords versus Kyoto is Kyoto had hard targets, measured targets, but only bound the wealthy countries, only bound the developed countries or what was referred to as the Annex One countries. Mm-hmm. Paris has every country, but in exchange for that, the countries themselves get to choose their targets or, you know, get to choose their national commitments. First, have those commitments been pretty aggressive? And second, have countries been meeting their commitments?
So under Kyoto, we had more of this sort of top-down system where the UN established the goal and then countries sort of argued back and forth to take what commitments were required to meet that ultimate goal. Paris is the opposite. It's more of a bottom-up approach. So every country creates what are called nationally determined contributions or NDCs. In climate lingo. And so what that means is they set their own baselines, they determine which industries are included and not included, they write the rules for carbon trading, offsetting, targets, however they see fit. Which again, on one hand is good because it did get more countries on board having that flexibility. That's why we have such international and universal participation outside of the United States. On the other hand, with no really sort of like goal mandated from the top and countries being able to do what they want or they feel is most politically or economically feasible for them, we have fallen short of the ultimate targets. So the bare minimum target established in the Paris Agreement is that 2-degree threshold or tipping point that's been identified by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the IPCC. There are a number of different organizations that have looked at this. If you try and add up the contributions of all the different countries, which by the way is very difficult because they all get to write their own terms and use their own mm-hmm. metrics. So they're quite difficult to compare. One group that's done a particularly good job of this is the Climate Action Tracker. Mm-hmm. And they've estimated that if you add up all of the Paris pledges, that still takes us to about a 2.8 degree world. Mm-hmm. If you look at the actual policies in place, it takes us more to about a 3 or a 3.2 degree world. So in terms of, you know, looking at, we can look at compliance, which is relatively high, but when we look at effectiveness of meeting our end goal of reducing global emissions, we're still very far off.
That was what the Climate Action Tracker, is that something that people can follow on their own? Is that a tool that's online?
Yes, it's a tool online. They rank the different countries. They haven't ranked all of them. Again, it's really difficult to compare all these different NDCs, but they have a ranking of countries in terms of who are sort of the role models to those who are really not meeting the ambitions that they could. And they've also started tracking those who have made their new commitments for COP26. Because one of the big things about COP26 is that it's 5 years since the Paris Agreement, and the next major step is to ratchet up, is the terminology they use. It's time for countries to recommit in an even more progressive manner. And so they're also tracking who has ratcheted up their NDCs and also the countries that haven't.
sort of last question, are you optimistic that there's going to be new commitments coming out of COP26 and kind of a newfound, you know, commitment to climate action, in particular considering the global recession that's been triggered by this pandemic?
I'm always one to lean towards optimism. I would like to think, even though it might be hard to feel this way in the context of American media, but I would like to think that coming out of the coronavirus or starting to emerge and to kind of rebuild and to restructure, that we will have sort of this more, a larger sense of sort of humanity and of multilateralism moving forward. Because when you look at coronavirus, no matter what, unilateralism is not going to get us a vaccine. It's not going to solve this problem for us collectively. And I think that same logic can be and needs to be applied to climate change. And so I'm hoping that perhaps as we start to see multilateralism work in response to the coronavirus, that will then bleed over into COP26. I also have great optimism when it comes to the role of civil society to be inventive and creative and to speak their voice no matter what circumstances they're confronted with. Mm-hmm. We saw this in COP21 after Paris had been the victim of a number of terrorist attacks and all permits for protests and things like that were revoked and civil society wasn't really able to be out in the streets. And they were creative in doing online protests, virtual strikes, geolocation events. So I think that civil society, along with developing countries, will still make their voices heard in COP26 and continue to urge developed countries to ratchet up their commitments.
Perfect. Well, if listeners want to follow you as you prepare for this, I know you're pretty active on Twitter and in social media. How can they follow you?
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter at Prof, so ProfSmGibson. And I post lots of updates with regards to COP26. Also, in regards to the other classes I teach on global public health, COVID-19, climate justice, indigenous issues. So please follow along if you want to see what's happening at the end of this year and next.
Thank you very much, Shannon Gibson. You've listened to Scholar Circle. Our guest has been Shannon Gibson of the University of Southern California. She is Associate Professor of International Relations, Political Science, and Environmental Studies, and is the author of the forthcoming Politics of the Global Environment, which is due for publication in spring of 2021. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back, contributing host Lillian Ng explores moral distress in a time of COVID-19. Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What are the implications of moral distress and clinical decision-making during COVID-19? Lillian Ng, our contributing host, explores this with Monique Jonas and Philippa Malpas.
What is the risk of moral injury to frontline healthcare workers? To explore this question, I'm joined by Monique Jonas and Philippa Malpas. Monique is an ethical theorist who specializes in healthcare ethics, distributive justice, and a number of other ethical topics. And Philippa Malpas is a medical ethicist and teacher in medical humanities. Welcome to you both.
Kia ora, thank you for having us, Lil.
So firstly, just acknowledging this extraordinary time of these world events amidst COVID-19 and the work that our essential workers are doing. Firstly, I wanted to ask you, what is moral injury and how does this differ from the term moral distress?
Shall I tackle that one, Philippa?
Yeah, go for it, Monique.
I'll get the ball rolling then. We can think about moral distress as being the state that we experience when we have a sense of what action we should take. So it's unlike a moral dilemma And when you're in a moral dilemma, you're not sure about how you should act. There seems like there's no good action or no action that satisfies all the ethical constraints that you see. When you experience moral distress, you know you have a sense of what action you should take, but you are constrained from taking that action. And it might be because of external constraints, like a policy that makes it impossible for you to take the action that you believe you should take, or it could be to do with internal factors. So distress is that the affect that accompanies that judgment that we reach, that the action that we can take is wrong. So that we can think about that as being distress. And I guess that moral injury is like the sequelae of that, if you like. It's what we are left with when we are in a situation that is so morally distressing that it leaves us with some kind of permanent scar. And so it could be an injury that results from an awareness that an action that we have taken is wrong, deeply wrong, like wrong in an identity affecting way. Not just wrong like I didn't give that person the right change at a shop, but affecting who you are either as a professional or as a person. Or it could be an injury that results from you being in a situation, being party to a situation that is deeply wrongful, where something wrong occurs. It might not be you that did it, but you're party to that and you don't prevent that wrong from happening.
I think often moral distress and moral injury are sometimes seen as one and the same thing, but I think Monique's made a really good distinction there. And I think moral suffering kind of can be thought of as like an umbrella term that sits over both of these, and that the difference between them really is that distress is a necessary condition for experiencing the injury, the moral injury. And certainly in the literature, a lot of the work that's been done in moral injury has been around veterans, the police, people who are experiencing really traumatic situations that can often lead to an altering kind of their beliefs, actually, their deeply held moral beliefs and expectations.
And that distress can be at many levels, mental, emotional and spiritual. And there's that link that you have made with those beliefs and values which are deeply held by people. How does failing to act in ways that transgress moral beliefs differ from making ethical decisions?
So when we're faced with an ethical decision or an ethical dilemma, often we're faced with a number of ways of acting, and we might have good reasons to think that we could act in any number of ways. So we might put forward those reasons, we might have discussions with others, we might think about the reasons for acting in certain kinds of way and come to a conclusion that I am justified ethically in acting this particular way, and these are my reasons. And people don't necessarily do that in any kind of formal way, but often that's how our thinking would work. We put forward the reasons for acting in certain kinds of ways. One of the challenges with moral distress in the particular climate that we're talking about is that healthcare workers and many instances will know what the right thing to do is, but be constrained from acting in that way because of the constraints that have been put in place. And in this case, it's around physical distancing. So some of the things that we may want to do to fulfill the kinds of healthcare roles that we have, we're simply unable to do. And that's across a whole lot of different situations. And an obvious one would be, you know, being able to comfort somebody who needs that because we can't physically touch other people, something that is parcel, I think, of care, caring for others.
What conditions and constraints are health professionals working under at this current time?
I mean, the points that Philippa has made about physical distancing and the impact that's had on healthcare workers in particular, I think that's really interesting to think through, because that affects the way that professionals express their role with patients. And it doesn't only affect how they connect with or have to isolate themselves from their patients and whānau, but it also affects the constraints that they place on families. So families who may wish to be with a loved one who's dying may be prevented from doing that. And that is going to be very distressing for health professionals who don't usually have to maintain standards like that or conditions like that. So there are those kinds of requirements, enforcing social distancing in situations where patients need more than ever to have the people who they love and trust around them. And then, of course, there's all the resource constraints, the constraints around who can have access to essential services like ventilation, oxygen, and how they distribute the means of protecting their own colleagues. So around the PPE, which has become a term that we're suddenly all familiar with. So, I mean, and that just gives you a sense, doesn't it, of how all-encompassing the changes are for health professionals. So they're having to make a whole lot of decisions and implement a whole lot of circumstances or conditions that really extend them beyond the way that they normally do their job. So there's the individual changes, but there's also just, you know, the collective burden that places on health professionals.
I was thinking about some of the questions that some of my colleagues might be having to ask themselves in other countries, like whose life shall we save? How can we save the most lives? Who will benefit most? Who will receive ventilatory support? And who will have a better outcome? How do we choose?
That's such an important question, and let's not hold, let's come back to that. I was just, you know, one of the things that I found really haunting over the last few days has been seeing some of the footage coming out of New York, but also Italy and Spain. And there was a photo I saw of a forklift putting coffins into a refrigerated truck in New York, and recognizing that they are facing hundreds of deaths a day. And there was a quote, and I just wanted to I think it's just so poignant. It says, personally, it's hard to go through this all day, and then it's hard to stay up all night watching those numbers come in and know that you're in charge of the ship at this time. And that was the governor of New York. And yeah, I think there's just something really distressing about what we're seeing in a short period of time.
So what sort of decisions are health professionals being asked to make about patient care under extraordinary conditions? Coming back to the questions I was asking earlier.
Doctors are having to make choices between whose life they prioritise for saving. And, you know, that is such a divergence from the framework that clinicians generally work in, which is that they are motivated to serve the best interests of every patient that they have. So sometimes they will make decisions about withdrawing ventilation, but that would be based upon a decision, a judgment that they make, a clinical judgment about what serves the interests of that patient. So for them to have to be in a situation where they believe that there are multiple candidates whose best interests would be served by access to that care, but only one or only these ones can have it, that is a huge change from how they normally operate. And they, you know, under that conception of a doctor's role obligation, where every patient matters to them, they're having to move very far away from that.
You know, it's interesting, isn't it? I was reflecting just last week about this very issue about how decisions are made to allocate scarce resources. And I was thinking, you know, sometimes in ethics, one of the things we do, particularly with students, is we present them with a hypothetical case or a vignette, and we say, imagine that you're in a situation like this, and then we'll present them with some kind of scenario. And usually the scenarios are to illustrate a particular point that we're making, but they often entail situations that most of us will never probably have to encounter. And it struck me that, you know, we are in times at the moment where the kinds of scenarios that we've spoken to students about, what would you do in a situation where you had one ventilator and three patients who needed it to survive, how would you allocate that resource. And this has moved now from being a theoretical discussion to a very real one with very real consequences. And I think, as Monique just said, you know, our focus in ethics at a time like this has shifted from one that has focused really on promoting the well-being of individuals to thinking about how we maximise the greatest benefits for the greatest number of people. And that raises some very interesting and difficult questions around who ought to get these resources. And I think we're seeing that in other countries at the moment about that allocation.
Yeah. Well, there's been some really interesting sounding boards recently from the New England Journal of Medicine. So one of them is called The Toughest Triage, Allocating Ventilators in a Pandemic. Or the other one, Fair Allocation of Scarce Medical Resources in the Time of COVID-19. So what you say about physicians being asked to make decisions they never have really had to face before, many of them aren't prepared for the magnitude of this time. In New Zealand, what dilemmas might we expect our clinicians to face?
Well, one thing that I've been thinking through, I see as being so essential in our context in New Zealand and not very well reflected in the international literature that's coming out about, for instance, prioritising access to ventilation, is how we serve the interests of populations who are likely to present with clinical considerations that will tend to block their access according to those utility-based criteria. So even where you feel like you're treating individuals fairly because you're applying the same requirements to each individual, you can be discriminating against a group who, for you know, systemic reasons, might present with more comorbidities or present later in an illness, so they will score less well on the SOFA score measurements and things like that, that tend to be used. I think that has to be absolutely top of mind for us. How do we try and balance our obligations to groups as well as our obligations to individuals?
What are the implications of moral distress for clinicians, our patients, and the health system?
Look, I think the implications, you know, we shouldn't underestimate them. And like you say, there are different groups we need to consider. When you look at a lot of the evidence around moral distress and how it impacts health professionals, compassion fatigue is a huge one. Sometimes that can lead to emotional paralysis where people just feel unable to think clearly about what their responses should be. People may end up, in the worst case scenario, I guess, leaving the profession. The avoidance of responses to certain critical incidents. I think there's a range of things we need to be very careful about in terms of thinking about the implications of moral distress. And I guess one of the things I've been thinking about more recently is what it means for us as a society as well when we see our healthcare system under such pressures. And the ethical issues to me at the moment, at the heart of this is around fairness and justice, but equally tied into that is the issue of trust. And of course, what we want is people to trust our healthcare system, that the kind of decisions that are being made on the ground, often in limited timeframes, often there isn't the luxury of being able to speak to people about situations, is that we lose trust. And so that is something that I think is really important for us to consider. And I guess that feeds into being transparent and as open as we can, being accountable for the decisions that are being made. And I think also being able to go back and revise decisions when greater evidence or better evidence comes to hand. So decisions around allocation might be put in place, but it's not to say that they're set in stone for the foreseeable future so that things can change. And I think where these kinds of decisions are made, they're much more likely to be accepted by teams, clinical teams and individuals in the public when you can see that decision-making process has been a fair one.
It's interesting thinking about the ways that individuals experiences of crises like this and societies, you know, how they mirror each other at the different levels. Because, you know, I think we sometimes, you know, imagine how we will respond in a crisis situation, and we have a sense of how we want to be, what values we want to express through our actions, and we hope that we'll be able to do that, but of course we can't always. Sometimes the situations overwhelm us, and that can be a very distressing experience in itself, you know, the realization that the person who you hoped that you were, maybe you haven't been able to be faithful to that through your actions. And I'm wondering about how a similar phenomenon might present at a societal level. So, you know, as Philippa said, you know, we're moving in, or many countries, when they're thinking about how to do resource allocation in these contexts, are thinking the way that we normally do it, we can't do it like that. Because of this special context, we have to apply different principles. We're going to be governed by utility, by trying to save the most lives or the most life years. But if that deviates from the things that we hold dear as a society, the way that we express our collective personality and our values, that could leave us as very unclear about what we really care about as a society. You know, do we really value people in the way that we say that we do? And so it could leave us with some real work to do on what our values really are and whether we can step away from those when times get difficult.
I'm going to say one of the things that has been really heartening over the last couple of weeks is to see the seriousness with which Kiwis have got on board with the lockdown. You know, I think, yes, we hear about the exceptions of people doing silly things, but on the whole, Kiwis have knuckled down, stayed in their bubbles, done the right thing. And I think that speaks volumes about who we are as a people, actually, that in fact, yes, it's inconvenient, yes, it's difficult, it's frustrating, it's really difficult for many families and individuals who, for whatever reason, have found themselves living in situations that, you know, they had to put up with because this happened very quickly. But people are doing it because they recognise the greater good here. And I think that's a real credit to us, actually, as a nation, and something that we should be really proud of. It's not to say that the concerns Monique has are not there. I absolutely think there will be a time when we need to look at, you know, what's happened and look at whether this has changed us.
I wonder if that's tapped into who we are in terms of our own humanity and our altruism, and thinking about how we've been deeply moved by seeing physicians initially weeping in the hallways because of the choices they've had to make, and the angst of withdrawing support for reasons that actually aren't related to patient welfare. Just going back to our frontline workers, what is the risk in terms of, well, what are the risks in terms of psychological injury to them?
I think that the risks will speak to their professional identity, to their sense that they can be effective and ethical practitioners. It can lead to people, as Philippa has already indicated, distancing themselves physically from, you know, maybe wanting to leave the profession, but even staying in their role and feeling unable to connect emotionally, to feel empathy for their patients, because it's too painful to feel like that continuously and always be the bearer of bad news. And I think that some of the subspecialties and specialties who are at the most risk here, because they're going to have to be making those difficult decisions, at least in certain places, people like intensivists, they already have a big burden. They're already having to encounter families and patients who are in absolute crisis. You know, some of the worst situations those people are ever in, intensivists accompany them, walk with them, and have to help them through difficult decisions, and sometimes make difficult decisions for them. And that requirement, that burden is going to be increased. So it's about the quality of what they're doing, but also the sheer quantity of it. And, you know, we can't, I think there's a limit to how much humans are able to emotionally engage with that, to feel it, to feel, move through it without being struck down by it personally.
I think the other dimension of this too is that, you know, these people who are at the front line have families themselves. They are at risk of transmitting and also being infected by this. So, you know, there is the professional obligations that they have, and often feeling distressed because they can't fulfill their obligations. But then there are their obligations, of course, to their families and their loved ones as well, and to themselves, to, you know, for their own well-being and their own self-care. So, you know, they really are extraordinary times. And I think, you know, this is such an important issue to be discussing. And I guess, you know, I want to sort of say, I think we really should not be underestimating the severity of what this means for many people who are at the front line. And then thinking about what we need to do to respond, of course, to moral distress.
Well, maybe we can talk about how we can respond from an individual and systems and institutional level, because there are going to be complications of grief and deep trauma from these burdens that you talk about, which are emotional, spiritual, and existential.
One of the challenges, and it's a challenge that can provide a key at an individual level, but, you know, part of the challenge here is seeing the limit of your own capacity and principle-based deontological thinking. There's a principle that's often drawn on, which is ought implies can. And that principle is supposed to limit your exposure to blame. So the principle says you can only have an obligation to do something if it's possible for you to do it. So it's a very kind of common sense idea, but it's easy to lose a grip on that when you're in a situation where normally you can do this stuff, but you can't do it now. Holding on to that idea that you can't be obliged to do things that you cannot do, that you're not blameworthy for doing things that are actually impossible for you. And to try and experience, I guess, a kind of a humility, but also a self-compassion, you know, to think about how would you help another person who was experiencing this sense of being overwhelmed morally. You would try and guide them gently to the fact that they weren't responsible for creating the situation, and they could only take the actions that they did. And it doesn't make the distress go away, and it doesn't also preserve you from the blame of others, you know, family members, for instance, who may hold you responsible for the fact that this patient, their loved one, can't receive care. But it's one step in to trying to diffuse some of that distress.
And I think too, you know, this is where I think the importance of having colleagues and having teams where people are not necessarily making decisions on their own. And I know through some of the work that's been done in different parts of the world, the allocation of things like ventilators, you know, who are making those decisions. And, you know, a lot of the work that's been done that I've been looking at more recently has been, you know, proposing that the teams who look after patients on the floor, so to speak, on the ground, are not the people who are making these kind of higher level decisions, so that there is a distancing, so that the people who are looking after patients actually can commit themselves totally to those patients and not feel a conflict of interest. And I think, you know, the teams supporting each other so that people are not feeling like they're making these decisions on their own. And, you know, I really love that word that Monique used, self-compassion, because I think that probably is something that many people are not particularly good at doing. But also I think for people who are also supporting teams, is to recognise the impact, I think, of things like moral distress and moral injury, and thinking about what it is to support people in a work environment, particularly around wellbeing. You know, I think this is something that we probably need to talk about more and more. And as is often the case, I think, in situations like this, you know, we learn incredible lessons after the fact. And I know earlier, Lil, you were talking about Waikare and some of the lessons that probably were learnt from White Island. And I wonder if some of those also are relevant here around that situation.
Well, there are certainly extraordinary and sustained demands on our healthcare workers and our health systems at the moment. I thank you both so much for joining me in exploring some of these issues. And thanks to our audience for listening.
Kia ora, Lil.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lil.
That's it for today's program, which you can hear again at scholarcircle.org. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. Special thanks to Artur Kaizakian, founder of Letters from Quarantine. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week. We close with Victoria Lynn McCoy reading a poem from the epicenter of quarantine.
Let this grayness hold us all with the kindness of its inherent uncertainty. An uncertainty that means even as darkening days are possible, so too is unexpected beauty. Let us each bear a gray that softens itself borderless and touchable. Let it bruise blue with mourning. Even as our lives hush with fear, I hear the wild parrots of Northeast Los Angeles trumpeting across the infant days of spring. Even as a spring that feels so out of reach, so many locked doors between, I dream the fevers break into blossom, that the weapons turned firecracker in your limbs braced for flight are drowned out by the singing of neighbors out open windows across this great divide. What breaks my heart most today is that how different our human longings must become may not be temporary. Left to wonder if the virus now dances through bodies we might have loved once, but held long enough ago that worry fades to want, or those we may have burdened with the need for touch. To think touch a burden now. How danger becomes the new language to say, I care, I hope you're okay. May we all danger each other to safety. May we all safety each other back to joy.